KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
What we don't predict and can't predict is who's going to do worse if they get the disease, and it may be your child.
In West Texas, health officials are racing to contain a fast-spreading measles outbreak.
An unvaccinated child has already died.
For Friday, February 28th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Adrian Florido.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, a meeting between President Trump and Ukraine's president devolved into a shouting match.
And later, in the history of modern U.S. architecture, black architects are often overlooked. A new program is preserving their work.
It's important to save these buildings because of the historical stories they tell, the social stories they tell.
We'll also take you to Greenland, where kayaks have long been a symbol of national pride.
I like creating kayaks because I can style myself, so I know it can be better for me when I compete.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. A potential deal between the U.S. and Ukraine to pave the way for an end to war is now up in the air. As NPR's Asma Khalid reports, it follows a heated public spat between President Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
Trump accused Ukraine's president of being disrespectful and unthankful for American support. The meeting became so heated that Zelensky left the White House earlier than expected. Zelensky was in town to finalize a deal that would give the U.S. access to Ukrainian minerals. But that deal was not signed. And Trump later told reporters that Zelensky does not want to make peace. But after Zelensky left the White House, he did an interview with Fox News' Bret Baier and insisted he does.
We want peace. That's why I'm in the United States. That's why I visited President Trump.
But he also repeatedly made it clear he wants security guarantees from the U.S. so that Russia will not reinvade Ukraine. Asma Khalid, NPR News, the White House.
Even as U.S.-Ukrainian relations seem to be faltering, it looks like the U.S. and Ukrainian foe Russia are moving in a different direction. Russia's foreign ministry says it suggested restoring direct air links between Russia and the U.S. during the latest round of consultations in Washington. Russian and U.S. diplomats met in Istanbul yesterday to discuss normalizing the operations of the respective embassies. There was also apparently an offer to restore direct traffic. It's not clear what the U.S. response was. Drug lord Rafael Caro Quintero was arraigned in a New York court today on sweeping drug trafficking charges. As NPR's Amanda Bastillo reports, the arraignment came a day after he and 28 other drug cartel figures were extradited by Mexico as the Trump administration aims to crack down on drug trafficking.
President Trump has pressured Mexico's leadership with the threat of tariffs and military action if they did not cooperate to tackle drug trafficking in the border region. Rafael Caro Quintero had previously served time in a Mexican prison for the murder of a drug enforcement agent, kidnapping, and trafficking. He was released from prison early, then charged by the U.S. in 2020 with smuggling thousands of kilograms of illegal drugs across the border. Attorney General Pam Bondi says his transfer to the U.S. was made possible by Trump's executive order designating cartels as foreign terrorist organizations. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, New York.
Last night's decision by a San Francisco court judge that mass firings of probationary federal workers by the Trump administration are likely illegal continues to reverberate. The decision is granting temporary relief to a coalition of labor unions and others that have sued the administration, seeking to stop the dismantling of the federal workforce. The judge in his decision ordered the Office of Personnel Management to inform federal agencies that had no authority to order mass firings. Lawyers for OPM, however, say the decisions were made by the individual agencies. Stocks gained ground on Wall Street. The Dow was up more than 600 points. This is NPR. The Muslim holy month of Ramadan begins tonight. In Gaza, many Palestinians are trying to put together what little they have to prepare for festivities and to mark the holiday. In Israel, security officials have been preparing in a different way. More from NPR's Kat Lonsdorf.
33-year-old Khalid Abu Sultan sits in the rubble of his destroyed family home in Jabalia in northern Gaza. He has just been to the nearby market, asking the price of every item, trying to figure out what he can afford. Ramadan usually brings joy and delight, but this year it'll be bleak, he tells NPR's producer in Gaza, Anas Baba. Meanwhile, Israel announced that security preparations for Ramadan have been completed, including reinforcements of border and district police in various locations. Specifically, police will be focused on the Old City of Jerusalem, home to many holy sites, including the Al-Aqsa Mosque, where Israel says it will implement, quote, safety restrictions throughout the holy month. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The decision by the Associated Press not to relent to the Trump administration and recognize the name change of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America has thrown relations with the White House press corps into disarray. The administration, in retaliation, has moved to limit the AP's access to certain events. The AP has filed a lawsuit accusing the White House of violating the Constitution. Trump appointee hearing the AP lawsuit says the administration seems to want to punish people based on their opinions, something he referred to as viewpoint discrimination. Crude oil futures prices moved lower today, with the market posting its first monthly drop since November. Oil fell 59 cents a barrel to $69.76 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Adrian Florido in Washington. Rural Northwest Texas is full of rolling plains and beautiful wide-open skies. It's also where officials are racing to contain a rapidly spreading outbreak of measles. Most of the state's nearly 150 confirmed cases have come from this region. On Wednesday, Texas officials announced the outbreak had claimed its first life, a child who was unvaccinated and was being treated at a hospital in the area's largest city, Lubbock. We've reached Dr. Ron Cook. He's a family physician and also the top medical officer in Lubbock. He's helping lead the public health response. Hello, Dr. Cook.
Hello.
Dr. Cook, why is measles spreading in the communities near where you live?
That's a largely unvaccinated community over there by choice. It's about an hour and a half away from us. And so measles is so infectious, it can really ravage through a population that's not vaccinated.
The epicenter of this outbreak is in Gaines County. I think that's where you're referring to.
Yes, Gaines County.
Can you tell us some of the things that you and other health officials have been doing to try to contain this outbreak?
Well, lots of education, of course. We've also offered a big, what we call an emergency response bus, a 15-passenger bus that's set up like a big portable clinic to give out vaccines, to do free testing and free vaccines, and lots of education in the community trying to get people to understand that this is a very safe vaccine to take, and then things to do in order to help prevent the spread of the disease further.
And what makes containing an outbreak so hard?
It's so virulent and so infectious that the problem comes if you're not vaccinated. So we put 100 people in a room, 90 plus people will be infected with this virus. You take flu, for example, you put 100 people in a room, one or two other people around you in the same amount of time will be infected. In this case, 80 plus, 90 plus percent of those people will be infected. It just spreads rapidly.
Measles was declared eliminated in the U.S. a quarter century ago, Dr. Cook, thanks to widespread vaccination. As you've noted, in these communities where the outbreak is spreading, a lot of folks are not vaccinated. There's a lot more skepticism about vaccines right now, a lot of that being fueled by officials at the very top of our government. Did you ever imagine you'd be trying to manage a measles outbreak of this scale?
No. You know, this is a very safe vaccine. You know, there's some association thought that it caused autism. That has been disproven, and certainly disinformation about this vaccine. It's been disproven over and over. You know, this harkens back to COVID days, and I think that's what it feels to us, the public health people trying to stop the disease. And I think because of COVID, we've had more vaccine hesitancy. So we're seeing certainly a surge in flu. We're certainly seeing another surge in COVID. We're seeing surges of pertussis, which is the highest it's been in 9 years. All of those are vaccine preventable diseases. And so we're seeing a rise in all of those. And it really makes us nervous.
How do you overcome some of these issues? How do you convince people to get vaccinated?
Just lots and lots of education, trying to get people vaccinated. We're seeing certainly a bigger uptake in making sure everybody has their measles vaccine up to date. So we've had lots of luck doing that. We've seen even in that community that's been somewhat vaccine hesitant, especially as of, unfortunate death that we had, they're seeing how severe it can be. And that's what I want to emphasize is what we don't predict and can't predict is who's going to do worse if they get the disease. And it may be your child.
I understand you have a 10-month-old granddaughter.
I do.
Are you worried about it?
I am worried about it. In fact, her pediatrician gave her an early dose of the vaccine yesterday, not on my account, but because the pediatrician was also concerned.
How long might it take to get this outbreak under control in your communities, Dr. Cook?
It's going to smolder for a while. Fortunately, the bigger cities like Lubbock have a pretty high vaccination rate, so it'll slow down. There will still be cases of it prop up. We've already had two in our own city from an exposure. There are people that cannot take the vaccine because they're immunocompromised or somebody that's younger than 6 months. Those individuals can't take the vaccine, and we don't want those individuals sick. And so it's going to smolder, I think, for the next several months.
I've been speaking with Dr. Ron Cook, the Lubbock Health Authority and Chief Health Officer at the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Adrian.
Kayaks are a key part of Greenland's history. The Inuit people of the island use them to hunt for food. And today, the kayak is a symbol of Greenlandic identity. Our co-host Juana Summers met some of the people carrying on the tradition in Greenland's capital.
I'm standing at the edge of a swimming pool as members of Nuuk's Kayak Club paddle their kayaks across the water. They come here when it's too cold to practice outside. Greenlandic kayakers are known for rolling.
They're literally capsizing the kayak with their own strength and having to use the torque of their bodies and the paddle to right themselves fairly quickly.
Those rolls, and there are more than 24 techniques, are part of what makes Greenlandic kayaking unique. I watch them practice for a while, and then it's my turn for a more basic lesson.
Let's do it.
The Greenlandic kayak is unique because plastic kayaks are usually wider and heavier, making them slower in water. Also, when we build it ourselves, we can customize the shape and size to our own preferences.
This is Pavia Tobiasen. He heads up the kayak club, and he's helping me get situated.
I've never been in a kayak before. Never. I promise to pay attention. Take this. My legs go forward. All right, we're learning stuff.
I take a seat in a practice kayak. Tobiasen hands me a paddle. It doesn't look like the type of kayak paddle I've seen before. This one is slim and narrow. The blades aren't very wide at all.
So I'm holding the paddle about shoulder width distance apart. Relax your body. You know, new skills. I'm going to try my best. All right, Pavia is hopping in the pool to help me out a little bit.
He takes off his shirt and helps me push off. I notice that he has a tattoo that says America on his chest. When I ask him about it, he chalks it up to an impulsive teenage decision.
We're taking a little lap around the pool here. Trying to keep this kayak straight. Varying degrees of success.
I make my way around the pool really slowly, and somehow I don't tip over.
All right, we've made it back to the dock. Thank you for dragging me back in. How did I do? Good? All right, I got a thumbs up. That's better than I expected.
Greenland today is caught in a tug of war between competing international tensions. They believe in tradition. They don't want to be Danish. They don't want to be American. They're Greenlandic. Keeping this part of their heritage alive is one way they're showing the world who they are.
What's most important is that we, as Greenlandic kayakers, are continuing a tradition that has been a part of our way of life for generations.
Pavia Tobiasen started kayaking in the 1990s, and when he started, he says there were barely any kayakers in Nuuk.
How do you feel when you kayak? What does it make you feel?
I can see seals, whales, and birds up close as they move along. Of course, when I think back to how our ancestors lived, I can really feel the deep connection to their way of life, and that adds to the feeling of freedom I experience.
To learn more about the ancestral heritage of paddling and building kayaks in Greenland, we headed to the kayak clubhouse. It's a small wooden building that overlooks the water, a rack of kayaks stacked up outside. A man is using a small knife, scraping away at what looks like a long string.
Tell us about what he's cutting there. What is it?
It's a seal skin that he's helping me take off the hairs because we need to make like a rope, like a string almost, goes on the outside of the kayak. My name is Ida Nilsson, and I am trying to build some kayaks here.
Ida Nielsen moved to Greenland from Denmark 4 years ago. Members of the club are here building their own kayaks.
You can put your like your tools or your paddle or your norsak. There's not really an American word for that. It's like the thing you use to throw your harpoon.
The building's small with low ceilings. There are kayaks, paddles, and long wooden harpoons hanging over our heads. All of these kayaks are made from traditional designs and materials, like sealskin, whalebone, and reindeer antlers. There are two men sawing part of a kayak frame as we start talking to 18-year-old Kaluk Jensen Poulsen. He's been building kayaks for 3 years.
I like creating kayaks because I can style it myself, so I know it can be better for me when I compete.
How did you get started building kayaks?
My dad used to build me kayak, and he was in cancer.
His dad was diagnosed with cancer, so he picked up the work. I asked him to show me his kayak. Today he's working on finishing the wooden ribs of the frame.
We steam it and let it sink in water and steam it and bend it.
You bend it so it makes the shape of the kayak that we're used to, that rounded shape at the bottom?
Today, kayaking is an incredibly popular sport in Greenland. There is a national championship every year that draws kayakers from across Greenland and around the world. At the Nuuk Kayak Club, one shelf is full of trophies. Nea Roke Peterson sits at a desk nearby. She says it's good that kayaks are used for sport now, but that it's important to remember the ways that her ancestors used them. Without kayaks, there would be no food, she tells me. Without kayaks, there would be no Greenland.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Cunard, offering travelers an opportunity to voyage aboard Cunard's Queen Elizabeth to Alaska. Guests can experience Glacier Bay National Park and Hubbard Glacier, as well as locally sourced cuisine. Learn more at Cunard.com. And from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Adrian Florido.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Modernist architecture emphasizes minimalism and functionality. Think buildings made of glass, steel, and concrete. Frank Lloyd Wright and Louis Kahn are two white architects who embrace this style, but modernist buildings designed by black architects dot the United States, and they're often overlooked. That is now changing for some. Reporter Buffy Gorilla has more.
I'm in Carson, California, 13 miles south of downtown Los Angeles, a city once known for its abundance of auto wrecking yards. It's now recognized for being the home of an architectural gem. I'm outside City Hall talking to Gail Kennard. Her father, the late Robert Kennard, was one of the three architects who designed the building.
The architects were modernist, and they believed in modernism as a tool to bring good architecture to everyday people.
City Hall's design in the past often had classic features, ornate pillars and arched windows. Well, that's not how Robert Kennard and his partners pictured their City Hall.
It's very horizontal in its design. There's a lot of light, natural light coming into the building is really important.
Carson City Hall has clean lines and a bright white exterior and is surrounded by trees and lush gardens. It opened in 1976, and Kennard says modernist buildings need to be preserved.
It's important to save these buildings because of the historical stories they tell, the social stories they tell.
Since 2022, two organizations have worked to safeguard buildings designed by long overlooked black architects: the African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund and the Getty Foundation. They've given out grants of up to $150,000 to preserve 16 different structures. Besides Carson City Hall, there's a swimming pool in Wichita, Kansas, a mosque in Washington, D.C., and several churches, including the First Baptist Church West in Charlotte, North Carolina.
This was the biggest black church in Charlotte at that time.
Harvey Gant is an award-winning architect and a former mayor of Charlotte. Now in his 80s, Gant remembers the challenges he faced.
We recognized that we were up against firms that had done nothing but churches. All of those firms were predominantly white firms, very good firms for that matter.
Black architects make up about 2% of all licensed architects in the United States. In the mid-60s, in the South, during segregation, becoming an architect was even more of a hurdle. Gant formed his firm, Gant Huberman, with his white partner, Jeff Huberman.
Bottom line is we got the commission, and that was one of the biggest days for our firm.
The grant means repairs to the sanctuary, roof, and baptismal area of the first church Gant designed.
I was flattered that anybody would remember anything that I did. I was just blown away by the fact that one of my buildings was being recognized.
In the northeastern part of the country, another church, this one designed by Walter R. Livingston Jr., is also on the preservation list. It's Zion Baptist Church in Philadelphia.
Thank you.
Associate Minister Mike Major leads the way to the church's red-carpeted sanctuary.
I went to daycare here, so I'm 63 now, so you're talking about probably 60 years ago, roughly.
Major says in its heyday, the church with its vaulted ceilings and vibrant blue, red, and green stained glass windows was a gathering spot for young people.
Many of us hung out here on Friday night at the choir rehearsal, so we just kind of hung out. We hosted parties over there. Everything was happening here in the building.
Major wants other people in the community to feel the same connection to Zion Baptist.
Places like this have a story to tell. When folks look at places like this, that especially in this community itself, this church represents hope.
The effort to raise awareness of black modern architects will continue with another round of grants. all with the goal of preserving their 20th century structures and recognizing their contributions to the built environment. For NPR News, I'm Buffy Gorilla.
One of the foremost interpreters of religion in American public life has died. Martin Marty was a writer, teacher, historian, and pastor. He was 97 years old. NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose has this appreciation.
For more than half a century, Martin Marty was the go-to interview for journalists trying to make sense of some religious moment. Here he is on NPR in 1976, explaining what it might mean that a born-again Christian was entering the White House.
The Southern Baptist tradition at its best is one that doesn't want merging of church and state, and all you ever have to do to someone like Carter is to remind him that he might be tilting that way, and he would back off very fast.
And here's Marty a quarter century later on NPR talking about concerns that presidents take their oath of office on a Bible.
It is terribly offensive if you create the impression that other believers or non-believers can't be full citizens.
More recently, Marty helped listeners understand the fiery tone of Barack Obama's pastor during the 2008 presidential campaign.
A lot of Jeremiah Wright's rhetoric matches that of Martin Luther King. When you hear King accusing the nation for an unjust war in Vietnam or for segregating, it's just as harsh.
He was the primary spokesperson for religion in America.
Catherine Albanese was a PhD student of Martin Marty's at the University of Chicago.
He had a way of framing the story in ways that resonated.
Marty won a National Book Award for Righteous Empire, about the American Protestant tradition. He was a magazine editor and columnist and was awarded the National Humanities Medal for increasing the public understanding of religion. Albanese says, in the same way Marty invited the public into understanding, he invited his students into the conversation.
I grew up in an Italian-American neighborhood. I didn't come from any kind of privileged background at all, and he welcomed me in, and he made me feel like I could play ball with this crowd.
Albanese went on to teach for decades at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and serve as the president of the American Academy of Religion, just a few years after Marty himself held that office.
He taught me to listen to the other person and be generous about the other person and feel some sense of the humanity.
Marty was an ordained Lutheran pastor and for two decades co-taught a course with University of Chicago colleague Clark Gilpin called The Public Church in America. Gilpin says Marty always insisted that books by Dorothy Day and Martin Luther King appear on the syllabus.
These were two different ways of thinking about people whose mission in life was transformation.
For Dorothy Day, an internal change.
In the case of Martin Luther King, if change is going to occur, and it must occur, that change is going to come from the margins.
From the outside, multiple ways of thinking about religion's role in personal and public life. Gilpin says it was a lesson Marty taught time and again, including in his groundbreaking study on fundamentalism.
Difference was not going to result in polarization. For Marty, it was going to result in a dialogue that led each one of us to a better place.
A place Martin Marty once described as a religious bazaar, an abundant market of beliefs and practices that add to the richness of American public life. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Dr. Maren Alsop says that performing her story, work about the fight for women's rights at the Kennedy Center, is of the moment.
We're reminded of the progress that women have made. And as we see today in our own country, how quickly we can lose rights that we fought for.
That story Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Adrian Florido. Coming up, the discovery of an old record is breathing new life into a genre of Soviet-era music that hasn't been widely heard overseas for decades.
This is golden era of our disco history. But now it's very rare.
That story after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Today's Oval Office meeting between President Trump, Ukrainian President Zelensky, and Vice President Vance got heated and turned into a shouting match. Zelensky was there to sign a rare earth minerals deal between the countries that Trump wants as payback for U.S. financial support after Russia invaded Ukraine. But after Zelensky told Trump Russia isn't to be trusted, Trump exploded. Zelensky left without signing the deal. Later in an interview on Fox News, Zelensky was appreciative of U.S. support.
Americans are the best of our friends. Europeans are the best of our friends. And Putin with Russian, they are enemies. And it doesn't mean that we don't want peace. We just want to recognize the reality.
Zelensky didn't give a direct answer when Fox's Brett Baer asked whether he owed Trump an apology. The Vatican says Pope Francis's condition has worsened after a breathing crisis in hospital this afternoon, 2 weeks after he was first admitted to the hospital in Rome with bronchitis. NPR's Fatima El-Kassab has more.
The latest statement from the Vatican says the Pope suffered what it called an isolated episode of bronchospasm, or a breathing crisis, early in the afternoon, which led to him vomiting and caused a sudden worsening of his respiratory condition. It meant the 88-year-old had to use an oxygen mask on his nose and mouth to help him breathe. The statement also said the pontiff always remained vigilant and oriented, cooperating with therapeutic maneuvers. This comes after a couple of days in which Vatican statements had described a slight improvement in the Pope's condition. For now, the Vatican says his prognosis remains guarded. Fatima Al-Kassab, NPR News, Rome.
Wall Street higher by the closing bell. The Dow up 1.3%, the Nasdaq up 1.6%, S&P 500 up 1.5%. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Texas health officials say the number of people with measles has risen to 146 in the rural West Texas outbreak that led to the death of a school-aged child who wasn't vaccinated. That's an increase of 22 cases just since Tuesday. Health officials say 20 people have been hospitalized. California's adoption rate for electric vehicles is higher than anywhere in the country. But as Tesla CEO Elon Musk takes a central role in the Trump administration, some Tesla drivers in the blue state are feeling conflicted. Laura Fitzgerald from Cap Radio has more.
Fred Liao has a sticker on the back of his Model 3 that says, "I bought this before Elon went crazy."
I felt ashamed driving Tesla now. I don't think it's right to very rich people to influence our decision-making process in a so kind of direct way.
Some Tesla drivers have even said they're considering selling their cars. James Salee, an EV expert at UC Berkeley, says California's EV market could start to feel the impact.
Because Tesla's such a large part of the market, I think there's a very real chance that this can have an effect on the market overall.
Salee says it's possible EVs could become more appealing in redder parts of the country. For NPR News, I'm Laura Fitzgerald in Berkeley.
And I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Adrian Florido in Washington, where a meeting at the White House today turned into a shouting match on live television. The confrontation between President Trump and Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky may make what was already a fraught relationship one that could break down completely. That, in turn, could change the trajectory of the war in Ukraine. For more, we're joined by NPR's Greg Myrie, who's covered the war extensively. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Adrian.
First, briefly describe, if you could, what happened when Trump and Zelensky sat down in the Oval Office.
So Zelensky began talking about the history of the war with Russia, and then Vice President J.D. Vance interjected, saying it was disrespectful for the Ukrainian leader to make his case in front of the media. All the journalists were there. Zelensky shot back that the U.S. could someday itself feel threatened by Russia, and this ignited Trump, who joined Vance in attacking Zelensky, saying, quote, "You're gambling with World War III." There was shouting, finger pointing, all with the TV cameras rolling. And Adrian, no one can recall anything like this happening before in the Oval Office.
It was a remarkable scene. This was something that was supposed to be a meeting where the two leaders would sign an agreement on sharing Ukraine's minerals. What happened to that?
The ceremony was canceled. Not clear if the agreement will go forward now. Ukraine was not very happy with this deal. It would have had to give half of any new revenues from natural resources. This would be oil and gas, uranium, lithium, to help cover the costs of the war. It wasn't really clear what Ukraine was getting in return. There's some vague language about security guarantees, but Trump has been saying he expects Europe to provide security to Ukraine, and he's been very non-committal about what the U.S. might do. So this hastily arranged deal, which was really just a framework without specifics, could be the first casualty of today's confrontation in the White House.
Greg, what does this mean for any U.S. military aid to Ukraine?
The U.S. is still providing military assistance to Ukraine. This is coming out of the big package that was approved last year. There are still a few billion dollars working its way through the pipeline, but that will be exhausted pretty soon. And even before today, Trump had made pretty clear he was not interested in providing additional assistance to Ukraine. Today's developments could further harden Trump's position, as he said to Zelensky, quote, "You're either going to make a deal or we're out." And he went on to say, "And if we're out, you'll fight it out. And I don't think it's going to be pretty."
Greg, if this rupture becomes permanent, if the relationship completely falls apart, if Trump cuts off aid to Ukraine, could Europe step in and make up the difference?
The short answer is no. Collectively, European countries have actually provided a bit more overall aid to Ukraine, military, financial, humanitarian, than the U.S. But Europe is simply not capable of replacing everything the U.S. has been providing. Europe is not producing enough artillery shells and other ammo to replenish what the Americans are sending. Ukraine uses U.S. air defenses like the Patriot system, and the U.S. supplies the missiles. Without those missiles, the system is useless, and the relentless Russian airstrikes are forcing the Ukrainians to use up their stocks. And the U.S. has a vast intelligence network that helps Ukraine target the Russians. Europe simply can't provide these kinds of capabilities.
Well, I've been speaking with NPR's Greg Myrie. Thanks, Greg.
Sure thing, Adrian.
Last month, one of the world's largest lithium battery storage facilities near Monterey, California, erupted in flames. People fled the area and schools closed as the fire smoldered for days. It briefly reignited last week, and residents are worried about their health. From member station KAZU in Monterey, Elena Neal Sachs reports.
Small clouds dot the blue sky outside Sherry Okamoto's house in Royal Oaks. That's a rural community about 6 miles from the Moss Landing battery plant. It's starkly different from the afternoon of January 16th, when a plume of stinky black smoke moved in.
As soon as I opened the door, I got hit with burnt plastic.
Okamoto says she didn't know what was going on. She and her husband were scared and started wrangling their animals, chickens, ducks, cats, dogs, to get him inside.
My eyes were burning. My nose was burning. We were already coughing. And we weren't out long.
That smoke was from a building that housed nearly 100,000 lithium-ion battery modules that store renewable energy but had caught on fire. Monterey County quickly issued an evacuation order for people nearby. Lithium battery fires are notoriously hard to fight, and firefighters said they had to let it burn out because water would have been ineffective. The evacuation order was lifted the following evening. No homes were destroyed, but there was evidence of the fire even miles outside the evacuation zone. Okamoto still has a bucket filled with thick black water that she hauled out of her duck pool.
There's oil and soot and powder, and that's what I stuck my hands into because I didn't want my ducks to get sick.
She says the water burned her hands and gave her a rash. The Monterey County Health Department says 49 people have reported symptoms. County officials say preliminary tests of soil, water, and air around the plant do not pose an immediate public health hazard. But two tests did show elevated contaminant levels that require follow-up. If people are worried, county officials say they should see their doctor. Meanwhile, thousands have joined Facebook groups where people are discussing the symptoms they think may be due to the fire.
I've had a lot of difficulty breathing. My heart rate will jump up like crazy.
Jen Wren lives about 12 miles from the battery plant. She's gone to the doctor's office 4 times in the last month.
The very first doctor told me, "You have allergies."
She asked for blood tests to check for the metals found in lithium batteries, and then had to go back for a redraw because of a lab mix-up. When she still wasn't feeling well, 5 days after that, a physician's assistant told her to see her primary care doctor.
"Which I can't get in to see for 3 months.
She thought maybe she had a sinus infection and got antibiotics from a 4th doctor, but she still didn't feel better. Meanwhile, the heavy metal test didn't show anything concerning, except, she says,
they end up testing magnesium instead of manganese.
So she's getting yet another test.
It's been really hard to get any kind of medical support or any medical help.
In contrast to county and state tests, San Jose State University researchers took a number of soil samples close to the plant and found a spike in 3 toxic heavy metals. They were hundreds to 1,000 times higher than before the fire. Don Smith is a professor of environmental toxicology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He says the state and San Jose test results look contradictory for a couple reasons. They sampled different locations, and San Jose State researchers only analyzed the topmost layer of soil. Some of the state tests included deeper samples, which, Smith says, could result in diluted levels of metals. He says people are right to want more clarity.
Collectively, the data that we've seen indicates that not enough has been done to determine what the risk to me may be if I was a resident in that area.
Smith says heavy metals in lithium batteries are toxic at elevated exposures. They can cause respiratory issues and increase the risk of neurological disorders and developmental delays in children. Vistra, the company that owns the plant, did not respond to questions about its safety, but has said it's investigating the cause of the fire. People who live near the plant have sued. They say Vistra failed to take proper safety measures. For NPR News, I'm Elena Neal Sachs in Monterey.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC, is losing hundreds of employees through President Trump's cuts to the U.S. government. But critics note that because of the way this particular agency is funded, this won't save the taxpayer any money. And they fear it puts the country at risk of another financial crisis. NPR financial correspondent Maria Aspen is here to explain. Hi, Maria.
Hey there.
Why is the FDIC important?
So it's a pretty boring sounding agency, but it has a very important job, preventing a banking meltdown. And now the FDIC does this in a few ways. It's best known for insuring bank deposits, meaning that when you put your money in a bank up to $250,000, you don't have to worry about losing it if the bank fails.
Right.
And that gets really important when there's a big financial crash, like in 2008, or even the smaller banking crisis we saw a couple of years ago. Banks collapsed, but customers didn't lose money. And then behind the scenes, the FDIC is also working to stop banks from failing in the first place. It does this by sending its employees to examine thousands of banks on a regular basis. And they're kind of an early warning system if, for example, a bank is taking on too much debt or other risky business.
So, Maria, now as the DOGE team overseen by Elon Musk is firing federal workers across the government, how is that playing out at the FDIC?
So an FDIC spokesperson confirmed to me that about 500 employees took the government's deferred resignation offer. There have also been media reports that hundreds more employees have been fired or had their job offers revoked. And this follows the playbook we've seen from President Trump and Musk across the federal government. They're firing workers and saying they're cutting government spending. But it's important to note that there's a big difference between the FDIC and a lot of the other agencies. And that's because the FDIC, as you mentioned, it isn't actually funded by the government. It's funded by banks, which pay the FDIC quarterly fees based on their deposits. So firing people at the FDIC isn't saving the government or the taxpayers any money.
So then what is going to be the impact of these cuts to the agency?
This is ringing a lot of alarm bells. I spoke with Mayra Rodriguez Valladares. She's a financial risk consultant who works with banks and regulators, and she's really worried about what's happening at the FDIC.
That is just literally one of the most dangerous, one of the most insane things I've ever seen. And I've been working in markets for over three decades. This administration is really sowing the seeds for the next financial crisis.
She also points out that the FDIC was already short-staffed, and it's been facing widespread employee complaints about a toxic culture. And the FDIC has admitted that its staffing shortages have already led it to miss problems at the banks that it monitors. Now it's losing even more people.
And what is the Trump administration saying then, Maria, about why it's making cuts at this agency?
So some of it seems to be about executive power. Last week, we saw President Trump sign an executive order that would give him greater power over independent agencies, including the FDIC. And a White House spokesperson told me by email that Trump is working to cut regulations because, quote, the personal financial situation of every American is top of mind for the president. But again, taxpayers aren't getting any savings from these cuts. And now we have a weaker FDIC with less ability to prevent another financial crisis.
I've been speaking with NPR's Maria Aspin. Maria, thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Adrian Florido. About a decade ago, music producer Vic Sahoni was in New York and stumbled upon an old record.
I came across this really dusty 45 by the band Original.
Original was from Uzbekistan, and this track had been recorded in 1981 in the capital, Tashkent.
And I remember hearing it and thinking, okay, one day I'm going to do something with this. But I never had an in. I never had an in to that part of the world until Anvar contacted me.
Okay, let's go. My name is Anvar Kalandarov. I'm from Tashkent. I'm a vinyl collector.
Calling Kalandarov a vinyl collector might be an understatement. He's like a bloodhound for rare Central Asian music. He showed Sahoni what he had, and they began to build a collection of rare Uzbek pop music from this same period, the late 70s and early 80s. Finally, in 2023, they met up in Tashkent. The plan? Track down the artists and reissue the music on Sahoni's record label.
After we meet in 2 weeks, I found all the contacts we needed.
But it wasn't just Uzbek artists. It was Tajiks and Crimean Tatars and Uyghurs, all of whom had recorded songs in Tashkent in this sliver of time when the city's music scene was thriving.
Tashkent was long this sanctuary for musicians across the vast expanse of the Soviet Union.
As they prepared the album, Sahoni and Kalandarov began to unearth a surprising history behind that musical sanctuary, including wartime displacement and a disco mafia. Today, for our weekly segment of short-form audio documentaries, we have a slice of that story. We begin in the summer of 1941, as Soviet authorities evacuated millions of people from Eastern Europe after the Nazi invasion.
In a sudden coup, Germany's military might has been thrown against her former ally, Russia.
One of the great untold stories of the Second World War was this evacuation. The vast majority were sent to Uzbekistan and its capital, Tashkent.
Evacuation was huge for the development of music in Soviet Central Asia. My name is Leora Eisenberg. I am a fourth-year PhD student at Harvard, where I study the development of Soviet Central Asian music. The entire body of places like the Leningrad Conservatory was in its entirety evacuated to Tashkent, which obviously had a huge impact on the development of music. And this creates obviously an incredibly diverse area.
On those trains were also engineers who could produce vinyl manufacturing plants. At the end of the war, they set up one of the key vinyl manufacturing plants just outside of Tashkent. And this, by the 1980s, was pumping out around 200 million vinyl records just within the Soviet Union.
With the death of Stalin, we see Nikita Khrushchev come to power, and Nikita Khrushchev ushers in this time period called the Thaw.
There was kind of a movement in the Soviet Union to liberalize the arts, in a sense.
This was maybe the first time that music didn't have to be overtly ideological. That was the period when Western styles were flowing into the country and it suddenly became legal to make music in them.
Jazz clubs being born, rock clubs from the 1950s and 60s that would open, eventually it transformed into disco clubs. But the propaganda, you know, and communication departments, you know, mandated that before the, you know, the needle dropped on vinyl or the party started, there had to be an hour lecture on, you know, Soviet philosophy and Soviet doctrine, just to ensure that there wasn't too much deviation.
My name is Alexander Nikolaevich Popov. In 1975, I created the first discotheque in Tashkent. We had the thematic and ideological portion of the night. Then we would start the dancing. We had the most powerful sound and lighting equipment. Each night had its own color. We took an old organ apart and removed the electronics. And we connected the keys to play special lighting effects that we projected onto a screen.
Within these disco clubs, you started having the sale of imported cigarettes, imported alcohol, imported Western clothing. And there emerged this kind of disco mafia, which said, this is an extremely lucrative business. And, you know, this is not small money. So the disco mafia emerged and they began controlling all these revenue streams. So you had the first inklings of free enterprise that the Soviet Union worked hard to ensure its music industry did not have.
When we started in the 70s, we were only playing Western music.
Pink Floyd,
Jeffro Tull, Black Sabbath with Ozzy Osbourne.
But 2 years later, the authorities began requiring us to play 70% Soviet music and only 30% foreign music.
There was not only a call from the very top to say, you know, you have to promote Soviet artists, it was Soviet youth themselves and DJs themselves that said, hey, why are we only playing Western music at our clubs? We have an abundance of artists, you know, Uzbek dance music, Crimean music influenced by American jazz or American funk. If you were from, let's say, Tajikistan next door, you had more of those influences in your music.
Oh, yes, just remembering. Boron, 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 boron. My name is Mahfirat Hamrakulova. I am from Tajikistan. That was 1978. And one day, the director from Uzbek record company, he invited me to Uzbekistan studio. There was a beautiful time. Tashkent was a very beautiful town. Uzbekistan accepted me. Uzbekistan gave me a power, you know? We know all singers from Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, like exchange between cultures, you know? Sometimes I just don't even believe myself what I have this life, you know?
So in the early 90s, right after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the record plant in Tashkent, in fact, all the record plants across the Soviet Union shut down. And with the collapse of these record plants, there's the demise of the music industry, all the money dries up. So, you know, preserving vinyl is not at the forefront of many people's priorities, right? Some of it sat at the plant until they actually destroyed the plant. Whatever the dead stock was, it went into people's personal collections, into private archives. But we were very fortunate because of Anvar's very enterprising digging work that he was able to find a great deal of the original records.
This is golden era of our disco history. But now it's very rare. It's music you never heard before. Listeners can learn a lot new things from a part of the world they probably didn't know anything about. It's an absolute bomb. You take it to a party and dance till you drop.
This collection of music from Soviet Central Asia called Synthesizing the Silk Roads is out now.
This is NPR News. Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Ha ha ha.